good afternoon to myself.
I see you over there.
In my cone of silence.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So, my name is Erin Ryan. I guess I might as well just confess that early on.
And I'm still Bill Cundiff, and what do we got going today?
Well, okay, so first, and I forgot the card. What the heck? I'm so discombobulated. You know, I'm just going to say it. I'm really excited that the campaign season is almost over, but I'm terrified that
that
the campaign season is almost over.
Yeah, I almost don't recognize her. I've only
just
seen
from
her,
lack
you know,
of
about 3 hours.
I was going to say for lack of exposure, but that makes it sound like there's something funky going on at our house. So let's see. We've got a campaign. If we're going to do local, let's just do local stuff here in Shasta County. We have a local GOP. ShastaGOP.com is your source of information. There is a voter guide there. There are directions to the headquarters, which are super simple. It's on the corner of Hempstead and East Cypress, right across from Lithia Chevrolet. Open Monday through Saturday from noon until 6. We have bunches of Trump gear.
Lithia Chevrolet is open Monday?
No, I don't know what they're doing, but the campaign headquarters is open.
Campaign. Oh, okay.
See, Bill doesn't get to work at the campaign headquarters because he gives people bad directions.
I'm easily confused.
you're fired again. Oh, wait, no, I'm lying. We always need volunteers. So, yeah, the campaign headquarters is open. So if you do not have a Trump sign, and I'm telling you, this is the year. I've got people who are worried, like, oh, I don't know if I want to put a sticker on my window of my car, and I'm not sure I want to wear a button. But I tell you, people are really, really looking right now for their people, right? It's very tribal this year.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are a Trump supporter, just come by, and it's $2.
You know,
get a little pin.
Put on a little Trump pin, and you're going to find out who's who at the zoo, because, boy, people do comment.
I got three of them out at the grocery store last night.
Yeah, people love them.
They're like, oh, I like your pin. I'm like, here, you want to wear it?
Yeah.
They do. They want to wear it.
They snap it right on.
Anyway, yeah, we started a little sign war in our neighborhood. It's not really a war. It's just sort of fun. We put up our Trump Vance little bunting and stabbed a few signs in the yard. And then the guy across the street put up Paris Waltz. And then two doors down, she put up a Trump flag and has a spotlight on it. And then the guy across the street from her went Harris Waltz. And the guy down the block from us puts a Trump sign out. So it's gotten kind of fun. Have a good time with it, but definitely.
And we got a flag. We got a Trump flag in the neighborhood now.
That just popped up, so we're ahead. Because, we're keeping score because that's how we are. And anybody who puts up something, we give them a pin and a bumper sticker. Here's your prize. Thank you for playing.
You're the free sucker.
So the stuff's really inexpensive. I've been finding stuff, and Brenda found a bunch of stuff. So we've got, Trump pins. They're a little small. They're little elephants, and they say Trump 2024. They're $2. Get a few of them. Stick one on your shirt and give them to other people and let people know that this is the year to vote early. As soon as you turn your ballot in, just remember it gets scanned back through the Registrar of Voters, regardless of where you live. It doesn't get counted, but it gets scanned back in. And your bigger campaigns that are burying you in mail and texting and phone calls will stop burying you in mail, texting, and phone calls.
And I know that works because I voted early, and a couple weeks later I got a campaign thing in the mail, so I went and voted again. And that time it took. I don't get them now.
You don't get to vote. I fill your ballot out.
Oh.
Bill has no idea what he's talking about.
What did I vote for?
Just for the record, I do not sign it. Here, sign this. But no, it's a good way to do it. It does stop the campaign mail. So if you have people complaining that they're getting deluged by campaign mail, tell them to turn in their ballot.
Vote often and vote early.
And don't wait till the last minute and then go, oh, it doesn't matter, and then throw it away.
Yeah,
for God's sake. There's a lot of stuff on the ballot. So if you live in Shasta County, go to ShastaGOP.com. We've got the propositions on there, lots of candidate information, and we can help you. And school board as well, actually, County Board of Schools. That's a county school board things. Those are big this year. We have endorsed some of those folks. So please go do your homework and turn your ballot in and tell your neighbors to put out a sign.
Yeah.
It's way more fun than you think. All right. Let's get with the program here. Literally the program. I'll just confess, I had a screw-up last week, and sorry about that. I thought Claire was on, and then I thought Dr. Chen was on, and I don't know, I got them all wrong. Got everybody on the wrong week. And unfortunately, Dr. Chen just called the studio while Claire was on. It's like, oh, God, it's still happening. I'm the worst. So Claire Lopez is really our guest today for sure. And I'm going to give you the short version, the fun version of her bio. It's all online at wethepeopleradio.us. But Claire received her BA in Communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and an MA in International Relations from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. She completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before she declined a military commission to join the CIA. And she's co-authored and published two books on Iran. She's the author of multiple book chapters, plus numerous articles on China and its civilian-military fusion biological weapons program. She's the author of The Rise of Iran Lobby and co-author and editor of CSP's Team B2 study. Maybe she'll tell us about that. Sharia, the Threat to America. So she's kind of in She is in the know about all this stuff. And we spoke with her a few weeks ago, actually. And the topic of the two-state solution with Israel and the Palestinians and all that came up. And that's I think that's kind of a fallback for a lot of people who don't know what's going on. Well, hey, why don't we just, the two-state solution, that'll be great. So we thought, let's have an expert come on and tell us how that may or may not work. I'm thinking may not, but we'll let Claire give us the 411 on that. Claire, it's all you.
Well, hello to both of you, Aaron and Bill. Good to be with you again and all of your listeners. Thanks for listening in. It's always great to talk with you all.
If you can figure out which week we're having you. We've never had that much trouble before. I don't know what happened. I've gone insane. It's campaign insanity. It stole my mind.
No worries. It got all straightened out.
Yeah.
All right. So where would you like to start with all this?
Well, for those listeners who might be of a Jewish or Christian persuasion, we can start with the Bible and the Tanakh, the Old Testament, as Christians would say, the Tanakh, as Jews would say, and the journey of Abraham, his wife Sarah, his son Isaac, to the Promised Land about, 3,500 years ago, moving from a place that today would be located in Iraq, maybe, a place then called Ur, on up to the Levant, we would say today, the shoreline around the shores, the southeastern littoral of the Mediterranean Sea, 3,500 years ago. And then, of course, comes Jacob, the son of Isaac, the 12 tribes from his 12 sons, and that was the Jewish people, the origins of the Jewish people in the Promised Land, in the Levant. And so that goes back 3,500 years ago. There's no way around it. The Jews, Israelites, maybe they were called at that time, been there, been on the land, promised land to them, a covenant between Abraham and Hashem. That goes back to biblical times. If people are familiar with their Bible, that's what it says. That's what is believed. And in fact, by archaeology and other studies done in the land of the Jewish people, it's very clear that the Jewish people's presence in that land goes back 3,500 years. As a matter of fact, the Jewish people are the only people on the face of the earth, actually, who have the same name, the same language, the same faith, and the same homeland for at least 3,000 plus years.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and they want to claim that they don't belong there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other thing that's been done more recently, and this is thanks to modern science, are DNA or mitochondrial tests of Jewish people of ancestries that go back all these thousands of years. And as you may know, the mitochondria is traceable through the female line. As we all know, of course, Jewishness is passed along matrilineally, that is, from the mother. Children born of a Jewish mother are at least ethnically Jewish. So the tests were done on people who were Sephardim, Mizrahi, and Ashkenazi. The Mizrahi, of course, are those who descended from the Jewish people who never ever left the land throughout the many years of exiles and genocides and pogroms. They were there all of that time, and their descendants. The Sephardim are those Jewish people of the region around the Middle East, North Africa, and on up into the Iberian Peninsula, for example. And these were Jewish people who were displaced by exile and genocides, and especially after the Roman times when the Jewish people were scattered from their homeland. And finally, the Ashkenazi are those Jewish people and descendants who probably traveled the furthest away from the Jewish homeland. Again, pogroms and genocides and exiles. And these were people who settled throughout Europe, then Eastern Europe, and all the way east into what would today be Russia. And then, finally, after beginning, well, a long time ago, but at least by the 1800s and Theodor Herzl, the return to the land, the return to the Jewish homeland, the people were gathered in once again. And then by 1948, of course, the UN recognized, building on what the League of Nations before that had established the modern-day nation-state of Israel in the ancient homeland of the Jewish people.
That's
why do you think this is not? I mean, obviously, it's history, so the information's available. Why do you think it's so? It's suppressed everywhere. This isn't something that's ever discussed. And how? I mean, what did that take you? 6 minutes? Five minutes to lay that all out?
Well, there's more. Partly it's because history in general is not taught.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of unpopular now.
I mean, go back and look at our own founding fathers and the ages, by the way, they were at the time of the founding of our republic. Take a Thomas Jefferson, for example, who was in his early 30s at the time he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And the other leaders were, some of them, in their 20s, some in their 30s. I guess the old man might have been Ben Franklin. I think he might have been in his 40s. But by the time these founding fathers of our own republic had gotten through what we would say today middle school or, you know, high school, they already had studied foreign languages, in particular Hebrew, Greek, certainly Latin, in addition to English. And yes, they knew how to speak English properly. But they had also studied philosophy. They had studied mathematics. They had studied history of the Western world, Western civilization to be sure, but also of the ancient worlds. Again, Greece, Rome. They were far better educated literally as teenagers, and this includes history, to your question, as teenagers, far better educated than probably our college graduates today. So it's a lack of teaching of history currently, and really for a long time here in the United States. So, you know, the students get passed along from grade to grade, whether they can read or not, whether they can do, you know, even basic arithmetic or not, and they finally get handed diplomas, and they're total ignoramuses. They don't know history. So that's a good part of it. But what you said there, Aaron, was another part of it, and that is the suppression of history, of the teaching of history, of real history. And I mean, modern, you know, technology has enabled the internet and social media and media of all kinds. And that enables information operations, propaganda, you know, all of the above, suppression of history, twisting of history. And then again, back to our schools, the failure, you know, to teach real history. So all of that contributes to it, I guess.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate because all these different, yeah, you see, I mean, you hear it too. I guess we'll get into all that later, but you know, all the Palestinian protest thing here in...
You mean pro-Hamas, don't you?
I was being nice. All of that. You look at that and you go, what are you thinking? Like, do you not...
Well, they're not thinking.
Yeah, there's
critical
that.
Critical thinking is unfortunately too often absent among today's students and professors. And here we have kind of a revolving door, don't we? So... the students come into these, well, formerly elite places of learning, Ivy League schools, for example. And, you know, these Ivy League schools have been funded for, again, decades, often to the tune of gazillions of dollars out of the Middle East, especially places like Qatar. That's home away from home for the Muslim Brotherhood. In the Gulf region, and Saudi Arabia, millions upon millions of dollars poured into these different universities. But with those dollars come strings. The strings attached include professors from those places. Mm-hmm. They include curricula from those places. They include Middle East studies departments, chairs, and programs from those places. So that all goes into the school curriculum. The students are put through all of that. They come out the other end with those diplomas in their hands, whether they actually earn them or not. And many of them go on the revolving door part here to become professors themselves, back into academia. Others go into government. They go into media. And other professions too, but an awful lot of them go back into academia themselves. So that's what I mean about the revolving door. And so then another generation of students in those places is indoctrinated instead of educated.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you wind up with a kind of a closed information loop. All right, let's mull that over. We've got to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Claire Lopez, and discussing kind of the myth of that two-state solution. So we're going to set that up and deal with that. Claire is our hostage for the whole 2 hours since I finally got the week right. Oh, my gosh. You can find all of this, and you can send the archive later from We the People Radio.
.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul, then it's just your body, then they go. What shall we do about them? Let me know you're here, 'cause my TV set just keeps it all from being clear.
guest is Claire Lopez, and I was going to give you another little blurb on her. So she served as a member of the Citizens Commission on Benghazi, continues as a member of the Citizens Commission on National Security. She was formerly the vice president of the Intelligence Summit. That's just a fun resume item. I would like to be the head of an intelligence summit for sure. She was a career operations officer with the CIA, professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies, and executive director of the Iran Policy Committee. So just in case you were thinking this was all just Claire's opinion, she's got the cred to back it up. She's not just some person coming on to chit-chat about all of this.
She didn't just read it in the paper.
Yeah, mostly no.
So Claire, where does... Or when did Hamas come on the scene? I mean, it's like we have a pretty good background on the Jewish people and how long they've been there. What's the story with Hamas?
Well, for Hamas, which by the way is an acronym, which means it should always be spelled in caps, H-A-M-A-S, which is the acronym for the Arabic. Harakat al-Islamiyya Mukawamiyya fi al-Iraqwa. I'm sorry, wait, let me start over again.
So it's not horrible,
Harakat,
awful maniacs. Okay, sorry.
Harakat Mukawama al-Mukawama al-Islamiyya, which means the Islamic resistance is what it means. So Hamas is the Gaza branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. So we really have to go back to the Muslim Brotherhood. Where did it come from? The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928 by a group of students in Cairo, headed by Hassan al-Banna. And they formed the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan. You might hear it, see it written or hear it said, meaning brotherhood in Arabic. They formed it because 4 years prior to that, in 1924, at the conclusion of World War I, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and we'll get back to this when we talk about the land that the Turkish Ottoman Empire once controlled throughout the Levant, but that land was lost to the Ottoman Empire, and Turkey was reduced to the country of Turkey as we know it today, with those boundaries. And a military man named Kemal Atatürk. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk is a nickname. It means father of the Turkish people. His name was Mustafa Kemal. He took over Turkey at the end of World War I, and he began to analyze why the Turks lost World War I. As we know, they were allied with the Germans. The allied powers, of course, defeated them. Well, he began to analyze why did the Turkish Ottoman Empire lose. And he concluded, well, it's because they did not keep up in modernization of civic administration of the state, modernization in terms of military technology. And he and those who ran the Turkish government then in the early 1920s decided that they needed to catch up with the West in all kinds of areas, beginning with civic administration, but military technology and every other kind of technology, railroads and roads and everything else, too. But in terms of the civic administration, they decided that governments needed to be secular, whereas, as we know, of course, the Turkish Ottoman Empire was an Islamic caliphate, the last Islamic caliphate, we'll get to that in a minute, until the current day. But the government needed to be secular. And the people could be whatever they wanted to be, but the government would be governed in a secular way.
But the people could be whatever they want. Yeah,
the
doesn't
people
really sound like it would work.
Continue to be, you know, Muslim or you know, the Christians had already been mostly murdered in, of course, the 1915 and onwards Armenian genocide, which killed a lot more than just Armenians, Greeks, and many others as well. But hypothetically speaking, The government would be secular. The people would follow their own faith. And so what Kemal Ataturk did was abolish the last Islamic caliphate. Now, a caliphate had existed since the time of Muhammad, if he ever lived, which we're not sure of, but just let's say he did. And after his reported death in the year 632 AD, there was a disagreement about who should take his place. And the majority of his followers said it should be decided by a group. They come together, they talk about it, they decide who will be the leader. Those became the Sunnis. That is the majority of Muslims then and to this current day, probably 80 or more percent of the world's Muslims are Sunni. But the minority said, no, it should follow down the bloodline of the Prophet Muhammad himself, meaning through his daughter Fatima, who married her cousin, well, they all married their cousins, Ali, and their sons were Hassan and Hussein. Well, this all came to a head in the 680 Battle of Karbala. Karbala, a place today, we would say that's located in Iraq, southern Iraq. And the battle pitched the Sunnis, the Caliph, Muawiyah, the battle took place against the Shiite, the followers, the bloodline of Muhammad. Now we're down to his grandson, Hussein, and they lost. They were pretty much wiped out, except for, I guess, at least one male heir must have survived somewhere, because from then on, there was a succession of 12 father-son imams, and we can get to that, but those are the Shiites. The Sunnis won. Well, that led to, on the Sunni side, a sequence of caliphates. The Shiites had imamates, the Sunnis had caliphates. And from that point onwards, until the 1920s, 1924, there was always a caliphate. Maybe there were even two or three sometimes, and they fought each other. But there was never not a caliphate until Kemal Ataturk abolished the last one in 1924, trying to secularize the governance of what remained of Turkey. So that was a complete disaster for Muslims all over the world. They didn't have a caliphate for the first time in hundreds of years. And that is why, 4 years later, the Muslim Brotherhood was established by Hassan al-Banna and his fellow students in Cairo, Egypt. Well, fast forward from there, the Muslim Brotherhood spread. The military government, governments I should say, plural, because many times there have been military governments in Egypt, suppressed the Brotherhood because they recognized them as threats to their own power. They didn't believe anything different. They were all the same Muslims. Their ideology was Islamic as you know, the Quran. But the point was, in Egypt you get your choice, a military government or the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood spread out of Egypt because very often they were suppressed in Egypt and exiled and kicked out. That's where the Gaza branch of the Muslim Brotherhood came from, called Hamas. Now, the founder was a so-called Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Ahmed Yassin first established at least one other organization founded from the Muslim Brotherhood. But by the late 1970s or so, he lived in Gaza, by the way. He lived in Gaza. By the way, 80% of all Gazans are Egyptian by ancestry. Just fun fact there. Sheikh Yassin obviously had come to the attention of the government of Israel, obviously. This is the 1970s. We know that at the time that Yasser Arafat, the PLO, were running around creating chaos.
And they were Shiites, is that right?
Hamas were Shiites. I'm sorry, no. They were all Sunni. Take that back. They were all Sunnis.
Okay.
These are all Sunnis. Meaning Yasser Arafat, well, he was communist too. He got the help of the KGB, I guess, but Sunnis. The PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, and its offshoots, all Sunni. Shiites, we can get to that later, but that's Iran.
Okay.
There was also an offshoot. There was a proxy jihadi organization established in Gaza by the Iranian regime called the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, and they are Shiite, but smaller. But stick for the moment with Sheikh Yassin. He comes to the attention, of course, of the Israeli government. They go after him. He winds up spending a stint in jail, in Israeli jail. But they let him go, eventually released him. And because at the time the PLO and Yasser Arafat were causing such mayhem and chaos, remember the airplane hijackings and other attacks, 60s right. into the 70s, the government of Israel, in my opinion at least, made a serious blunder. And they decided to back Sheikh Yassin as a counterweight to the PLO and Yasser Arafat. And they actually did that. Big mistake. But fast forward through a bunch of history till the 1980s. And in the latter part of the 1980s, 1987, Hamas was formally established. That's when it was formally established. Its predecessor is everything I just told you. But it was established formally in 1987. The Hamas Covenant is published online. You can see it in English online on the Internet. Just look up Hamas Covenant. It's sometimes called a charter, but I always call it a covenant for the simple reason that, in my mind, a covenant is something established between men and God. A charter is between men and men. But this, Hamas's covenant, was between the founders of Hamas and Allah, which is simply Arabic word for God. And so I call it a covenant. But it's online. It's in English. And of note, in the first opening lines, it says this. It says, Israel exists and will continue to exist until Islam, not Hamas, until Islam will obliterate it as it has obliterated others before it, end quote.
Wow. That sounds like a recipe for peaceful coexistence right there.
And that's how they were able to take over the government leadership of Gaza?
Later. First comes the First Intifada, as you probably know, which broke out in 1988. That was the First Intifada. And that was, all over attacks against Israel, in which Hamas participated, but also out of Judea and Samaria, militias there, Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, and many others, out of townships like Jenin and Nablus and Tulkarm and all the rest. So that was the First Intifada, and Hamas was part of it. That really broke, any thought of collaboration between them and the Israeli government. Now, fast forward a bit more. In 1993, we had the Oslo Accords, which granted, inconceivably to me and many others, granted recognition, official recognition to the Palestinian Authority, which was basically comprised of the PLO and Yasser Arafat's other organization, which was established about 1958, the PLO in 64. That's what made up the Palestinian Authority. Granted recognition, and not only that, but they eventually won Nobel Peace Prizes. It blows my mind. But in any case, that's 1993. And as Yasser Arafat admitted openly in Arabic, but which maybe many people don't understand, but openly admitted that in Islam, a temporary cessation of jihad is called a hudna. We might translate it as ceasefire, but it's more like a temporary break in the fighting until the forces of Islam can regroup, rearm, and get themselves ready for the next phase of jihad. Well, That's what Yasser Arafat called the Oslo Accords, a hudna. Dates from the time of Muhammad, and that's all historical stuff, where that term and that policy come from. But I don't know why people didn't notice this or recognize this at the time, but he very openly said this is nothing more than a hudna. Well, so it was. Because by the end of the 1990s, come up to 2000, the year 2000 actually, was launched the Second Intifada. And that was the one with all the horrible suicide bombings on school buses and parlors and all of that. I've been to Israel multiple times, and on one of our trips, that was the theme of our trip, to visit all those places hit during the Second Intifada. The Park Hotel in Netanya, for example. Oh, we had the most graphic description of that suicide bombing, which took place in the hotel with a suicide bomber. But in any case, the Second Intifada, and again, Hamas was part of that, as well as attacks coming out of Judea and Samaria, same places as we said before. And after that...
Hold that thought, Claire, so we don't have to... I was looking for a good place to interrupt. There never is a good place.
Okay.
So just a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. And you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good job, Bill.
Oh, thanks, sir. Stand your back, shift your arm, then you pull it back. Life's hard, you know. So strike a pose on a Cadillac. If you want to find all the cops, they're hanging out in the donut shop. They sing and dance. They spin the truck, booms down the block.
Okay, without interruption, cut right back in, Claire.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Carry on. We won't distract you from the... You were on a roll.
Okay, so, all right, we brought this up to the Second Intifada that broke out in 2000, lasted for several years, unfortunately. But... What next occurred was that the Israeli government, then under Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, decided, I guess, that Gaza was more trouble than it was worth. Or somehow that trading land for peace was a good idea. So in 2005, the Israeli government completely pulled out of Gaza. Not only the government pulled out, they uprooted every last Jewish person in Gaza and sometimes dragged them out of Gaza. They dragged everybody out of their synagogues. They even dug up the Jewish cemeteries and brought the bodies back for burial. So they were gone. Israel was out of Gaza by 2005. The next year, 2006, there were elections. The PA, Palestinian Authority, against Hamas. Well, in Gaza, Hamas won. And by the following year, 2007, they were throwing the remaining Palestinian Authority people off the tops of roofs in Gaza. So that was the end of the PA authority over Gaza or presence there at all. And the PA, of course... retreated, I guess you would say, to Judea and Samaria and rules out of Ramallah. But back there in Gaza now, at least from 05, you could say maybe from 07, okay, Gaza was essentially an independent, self-governing entity. The world showered Gaza through the United Nations, UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Works Agency, and in other nonprofits and charitable organizations and banks and you name it, absolutely showered Gaza with money.
Which was basically Hamas at that point.
Hamas was the governing authority in Gaza, elected by the people of Gaza. Well, you might know what a beautiful climate that part of the world has. If you've ever been to Israel, certainly it's the same in Gaza. Beautiful Mediterranean shoreline, a temperate climate where you can basically grow anything you want. Of course, Gaza shares all of that abundance with Israel, too. The other thing about Gaza people may not know is that one of the world's largest freshwater aquifers lies underneath Gaza. And all they need is pumps to bring the water up and distribute it throughout Gaza, to the people, to wherever, throughout Gaza. That needs electricity, yeah. And even now, post-2005, Israel was supplying Gaza with electricity. Also, providing workers from Gaza, like 20,000 a day or something, with jobs, construction, yard work, gardening, you name it, in and around the Gaza periphery, and further on into Israel. These workers came across the crossing checkpoints every single day and had jobs. And so you would think, you know, that this place could have been turned into, Singapore of the Middle East or something, right? It had every advantage.
Well, yeah, they had the money, they had the water, they had,
they had the beaches, they had the climate, they had agriculture. By the way, the Israelis left behind a large set of greenhouses. Which they, the Jewish people, had used to cultivate all kinds of, vegetables and fruits and herbs and whatever else. And the moment, back to 05, the moment that the Israelis had pulled out of Gaza, Hamas and the people of Gaza destroyed the greenhouses. They absolutely wrecked them. They tore them down. They obliterated them.
Because they were built by the Jewish people.
Yeah, that's why. That's why.
Wow.
Moreover, they did not use all that money flowing into Gaza to help the Gazan people or to improve their lives in any way. Schools, roads, all that, water, pumping, all of that. Electricity. No. What they did instead was turned all that money to building tunnels. I've been in one of them, crossing over from Gaza into Israel, which they intended to use and have used, tried to use, did use, to channel Hamas terrorists into Israeli communities and kibbutzim. And they also spent probably a lot of money on weapons, which were imported, many of them, from Iran. It's also its financial sponsor. Qatar was another financial sponsor. But a lot of the weapons, or the components to make the weapons, came in from Iran. And in particular, all that supply came across tunnels built under what's called the Philadelphia Corridor. This is an 7 kilometer long barrier or corridor that sits between the southern part of Gaza, that would be Rafah, the southernmost community of Gaza, and the Sinai Desert, meaning Egypt, right?
Right.
Which, by the way, of course, Israel returned back to Egypt after having conquered it in the 67 war. So
at this point, the people that were supplying the financial aid to Gaza knew where the money was going.
Oh, sure they did. Of course they did.
Yeah. Okay.
There's no way they didn't know. And so a lot of these tunnels, again, though, went from Egypt, that is the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt, across the Philadelphia corridor into southern Gaza. That's the most, I guess, used, the most important place that the weapons and ammunition and everything else came in, and particularly that was from Iran. Now, don't anybody even suggest that the government of Egypt, that is President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, didn't know about this. His family was making money hand over fist by charging smuggling fees to transport all of this from the Sinai, from Egypt, into Gaza.
Right.
They were complicit. They were completely complicit. Of course, now, as we know, Israel, in its military campaign in Gaza, has reached through to the bottom, the southern part of Gaza, and sealed off the Philadelphia corridor, which the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, really need to keep control over for the foreseeable future, so that those tunnels, which they have now discovered, and again, remember, I said about 8.7 kilometers, I think it's more or less that amounts to, I don't know, it's something like 10 or maybe 11 miles across. It's not very much. But there were like dozens and dozens and dozens of tunnels from the Sinai side into Gaza across there.
And I've seen pictures of those tunnels. It had to cost,
oh my gosh,
a fortune to build those tunnels.
Yeah, yeah. There were larger ones and smaller ones, but that is where the money went. While the people of Gaza, you know, suffered through poverty. I mean, they weren't taken care of. But nevertheless, let's remember, who are Hamas? They did not parachute in from Mars.
Right.
Hamas are the husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers of the Gazan people. That's who they are.
Right,
right. They make it kind of sound like it's an occupying army.
They're not, not at all.
All poor people
that
aren't involved.
And remember that on October 7th, the Shabbat massacre of 2023 last year, actually perhaps more Gazan civilians came across into Israel to rape, murder, pillage, loot, burn families alive, babies. More even than Hamas terrorists themselves.
Yeah.
Wow, and you don't hear that.
No.
You don't hear that at all.
It's pretty much out there. It's just a matter of time, and how much time do you have to actually, you know, spend looking at it all.
Right, but that isn't made clear, I guess.
A lot of, we're back to the information, aren't we?
Uh-huh.
And the media.
That's why I thought this was just really important, because this all gets dealt with in, you know, a minute and a half, and it's too complicated for that.
There's a lot to it. So the last thing I'll say about this, though, is that we were picking up from our last conversation some weeks ago about a two-state solution.
Right.
Now, I know you'll probably have to take another break again, and we can get back to what I consider the first possibility of a two-state solution, that being Jordan. Let's look at Gaza here. That was their second chance at a two-state solution.
Right.
It was governed. It was administered completely by Hamas from at least 2007, I would say from 2005, to October the 6th, 2023. They had the chance to turn that into really a very thriving enclave, but they did not, did they?
No.
They had that chance. That could have been a second chance.
Which is why we shouldn't fall for that again. We're going to come right back. Our guest is Claire Lopez, and you're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
We will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your mind.
afternoon, and welcome to another...
There you are.
Yeah, there I am.
Yeah.
I can never tell. Is it me or is it not me? This is the second hour of We the People. We are on with our guest, Clara Lopez. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
So we have a couple little announcements. We have a GOP headquarters here in Shasta County. You can find it at ShastaGOP.com. And we are located at 150 East Cypress, right across from Lithia Chevrolet in the two-story brick building. So on the website there, we've got all sorts of endorsements and voter guides and all that sort of info, because our ballot this year is really, really busy. If you want to drop your ballot off and have us take it up to the registrar of voters directly for you, we would be happy to do that. We'll have a box there starting on Monday. And that's mostly all sorts of good pins,
of gear.
Pins, signs, all sorts of good stuff for you, so you can
for all the candidates
encourage people to get out and vote and get that in now. The other thing I got during the last half of the program is from one of our listeners is the Walk for Freedom, and that is happening. I'm trying to scroll this on my phone here. Walk for Freedom Reading is our global awareness event, rallying tens of thousands of people, taking millions of steps in hundreds of cities worldwide. They want to disrupt the existence of modern-day slavery, shaking the very foundation with our cities and our communities around the world. So this is happening October 19th from 8 to 4, Lake Reading Park Gazebo and Pavilion on 56 Quartz Road, Reading. So that's October 19th. That's next Saturday from 8 to 4. And then, hold on here. Oops. Trying to scroll this stuff on my phone, which is too small, of course, on things like this. Here we go. And then lighting the night for that, Save the Children, a candlelight vigil is happening at Turtle Bay Exploration. Oh, my gosh. What's going on? My lips have gone crazy. Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Go ahead. You say it, Bill.
Well, they drive me crazy.
I'm having a hard time with that. Exploration Park. That is Wednesday, October 23rd from 7:30 until 8:30 p.m. And I will post that on today's page since I did such a terrible job of announcing it. But got a couple things coming up for that, and that is super important. The human trafficking is obviously a massive, massive problem, and try to do a show on that here in the not too distant future. So we're going to cut back to the myth of the two-state solution with our guest Clara Lopez. One little additional blurb. She's been a visiting researcher and guest lecturer on counterterrorism, national defense, and international relations at Georgetown. She's a regular contributor to a range of media, including ours, on China, Russia, Iran, and the Middle East. And we have benefited from her knowledge for many years. I have a tab on the website at wethepeopleradio.us called National Security and Government Issues, and lots of shows with Claire on there. So you can get more information on, she's done a bunch shows with us on Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood and all that. Super interesting. So, Claire, before we move forward on the two-state solution thing, let's tag into where we were at the end of the last hour with the fact that so many of the people in Gaza, because the way it's being portrayed is that Hamas is like this isolated occupying army that has nothing to do with the citizenry in Gaza, and they ran across the border and did this massacre.
And moved into all the homes and stored all their weapons there, and the people had no choice.
And now they're being victimized because of these guys. So maybe you could disabuse us of that whole notion there.
Yeah, well, we made the point the last hour or so that, first, over 80% of the Gazan people are of Egyptian ancestry. That's where they or their fathers, mothers, grandparents came from. And we talked about the origins of Hamas itself and how it came to exist in Gaza. And, of course, that was formed from the Muslim Brotherhood, whose roots are, of course, in Egypt. The history is that Hamas, for better or for worse, they are the husbands, fathers, sons, and brothers of the Gazan people. There's just no getting around any of this. That's who they are. Again, as I said before, they did not parachute in from Mars. They are by and from the people of Gaza.
Right, and when Israel pulled out of Gaza, turned it over to the Palestinians, they were financed heavily and elected to use that money for tunnels, weapons, rather than build their society and improve the lives of the people.
Yeah,
they went the other way. And now,
exactly.
Yeah, and
the reason, of course, is that Muslim Brotherhood, you know, the covenant that we spoke about, but more basically, Islamic doctrine itself commands every Muslim everywhere on earth for all time to engage in, participate in jihad in one form or another. Now, that form could be speaking, it could be writing, it could be teaching, and it could also be financial. But yes, it is often most thought about as kinetic, as warfare. And in the books of law, which unfortunately I've spent way too much time with, jihad is explicitly defined as warfare against the non-Muslim. And it is its purpose is to spread Islam. And so that is why you have the true believers. These are the most devout, faithful, practicing, obedient Muslims on the face of the earth, except for the Taliban, Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and all the rest. That's what it means to be a faithful, obedient Muslim. It is to obey the doctrine and the commandments of Islam. Just as for Jews and Christians, to be faithful and obedient and devout is to follow the commandments of the faith. So it is for them. Except the problem is that the commandments of that faith are to fight and kill the infidel.
Right.
And that is repeated throughout the Quran in many, many places. But in Gaza in particular, that infidel close by are the Jewish people.
Right. And so we move forward, and now we're hearing the only way to make this work is a two-state solution.
Yeah. So we talked about Gaza as what I think of as the second chance at a two-state solution, which they, of course, completely blew.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many chances before that, too, and after that, as a matter of fact, really. There were many offers from successive governments in Israel. Oslo for one of them. But other talks and other conferences and under United States presidents like Bill Clinton, for example, through the 1990s and beyond Oslo, many, many offers of land for peace, including under various different prime ministers of Israel. Very generous offers that would have split Jerusalem, the eternal and supposed to be undivided capital of the Jewish people forevermore. Offers to split Jerusalem, offers to give up Gaza, offers to give up land in Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria are the heartland of Eretz Israel, of the Jewish people back again to biblical times. But the offers were made over and over again to share parts of that land with the Arabs and the Muslims of that area. There's, by the way, there's no such thing as Palestine, never has been. Never will be, hopefully, nor Palestinian people. You know where that term comes from? It comes, again, out of the Tanakh, that is Old Testament for Christians. And it comes from the ancient Israelites who, after Moses led them out of bondage in Egypt, something like 1400 B.C., if I'm remembering right, something like that, And the Israelites came back to join their Jewish brethren who had never left the Promised Land, but they were led out of Egypt by Moses and then later by Joshua and the rest. They reestablished, you know, the homeland of the Jewish people. Well, there were others in the area living there, Canaanites, Jebusites, Amalekites, and so forth and so on, but also a people called the Philistines. Mm. The Philistines were actually Indo-European people. They were not Semitic at all. They had moved to that southern littoral of the Mediterranean Sea following the Trojan Wars. You know, Iliad and the Odyssey, all that, right?
Yeah.
At the end of those wars, the fighters dispersed back to various places where they had come from or other places. And a bunch of them called the island people because they came out of the Aegean Sea, Mediterranean area. They moved onto the Levant, the southern littoral of the Mediterranean Sea. And they were called Philistines. That's who they were. Well, remember we talked about all the genocides and the exiles of the Jewish people throughout the years? Well, during the time of the Roman Empire, when that part of the Levant was called Judea, the province of Judea, Judea because Jewish people of the Roman Empire, they rose up time after time in revolt against the Roman Empire. The Jewish people did. Well, finally, there was a revolt in the years about 134, 35, 36, Common Era, CE or AD, the Bar Kokhba Revolt. That was the name of a clan of Jewish people, and they rose up against the Roman Empire, and they lost again. They were defeated. But this time, the Romans decided they'd had enough of Jewish revolts. And so they not only, you know, slaughtered and enslaved and exiled the Jewish people from the land in a wholesale manner after the defeat in 136 or something like that, AD. But what else they did, the Romans, is renamed the region. As we said, it was called Judea, the province of Judea of the Roman Empire before. After the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Romans changed the entire name of the place. And hunting back through the Old Testament, they came upon the name of the Philistines. Remember David and Goliath?
Oh, yeah.
Goliath was a Philistine. They were enemies in the Old Testament. The Israelites, of course, emerged victorious in the end, not just David over Goliath, but in the end. And the Philistine people literally disappeared, speaking as a people. They were absorbed. There just weren't any more Philistine people, or Canaanites, or Jebusites, or Amalekites. They were all absorbed and gone from the pages of history. But the Romans went back into the Old Testament, and they found the name. And they realized, oh, these were the real enemies of the Israelite people. Let's call this land that we've now erased the name of Judea from, and we're going to call it Philistia. They put that name on the land to erase the identity of the land and any connection it ever had with the people of Judea, of the Jewish people. That's where the name comes from.
Okay.
No kidding.
And that goes back to the 2nd century AD, right? That's when that name was stuck on there. Well, it wasn't a country. It wasn't, a people, per se. It was just a name, a geographical name that the Romans slapped on the area to remove the identity with the Jewish people. That's all it was. There was no country named Palestine. There was no people named Palestinians. It doesn't exist. Never has existed. So in any case, let's fast forward now.
Hold on. Let's take a quick break so we can do that all at one time. Wow. Okay, well, that's because there are always all these memes that come out, you know, history of Palestine Museum, and it's a big room with white walls and nothing in it. Have you seen that?
Pretty much.
Yeah, that explains that. I'll have to post that too, since it's fun. So, take a quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Claire Lopez. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I can't get these memories out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve. I tried so hard to let you go, but some kind of madness is swallowing me whole. Yeah.
I moved out to Langley recently with a plain and simple dream. Wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their mansion suitcases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on. Got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my weapon drawn. So I get my handcuffs, my cyanide pills, my classified dossier. Timing the phones like, yeah. Shredding the files like, yeah. And then memorized all the enemy's spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah. It's a party in the CIA.
Claire had nothing to do with that. That was uncalled for.
It's been very serious, but I'm like, you know, declined the military commission to join the CIA. I'm like, there's a song about that.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. So just in case you've never heard that one, there you go. I wrote a special song for you. I'm sure it's just like that, too. Oh, my goodness.
Not so much.
Not so much.
Darn it. It sounds so much fun. Okay. So the brief fun break is over now. Back to the whole thing. Well, so I think the myth of Palestine, actually, is probably what I should have called the show, The Myth of Palestine. So go forward with that. How do we wind up with this whole big, you know, belief that these guys have, you know, this homeland?
They've been robbed of their homeland.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That
right.
whole thing.
So again, remember, the name originates with the Romans who took it out of the Old Testament. That's where it originally comes from. Now, let's move forward to the dawn of Islam. So again, as we said before, if Muhammad ever lived, he launched the jihad part of Islam after the hijrah, that is the move from Mecca to Medina that took place in the year 622. So now they're in Medina. From Mecca to Medina they moved, and that begins the kinetic history of jihad as history knows it. The Islamic forces burst out of the peninsula. Today that's the Arabian Peninsula, in all directions, conquering east, west, and all over. And by about 636, I think it is, they had conquered Jerusalem and ruled over that part of the Middle East and much else, all the way across North Africa, as far as Morocco, now south as far as Nigeria, as far east as India, of course. They conquered over the, you know, subsequent years, on up into southeastern Europe, the Iberian Peninsula, gates of Vienna, finally 1683, is when they finally began to be turned back. But the point being here that the forces of Islam conquered the land of the Jewish people by the 630s, let's say, and ruled over it, you know, one caliphate succeeding another for the next hundreds and hundreds of years. Now, there is part of doctrine in Islam that says any land ever conquered or occupied by Islam is forever waqf. Waqf, W-A-Q-F, is an Arabic word that means land endowed by Allah, by God, to Islam in perpetuity, forever and ever. And if ever that land is lost to Islam, it must be fought for and fought for until it's regained, which is why we see continuing jihad throughout lands that once were Islamic by conquest.
Well, we all know that every war, I mean, just because you win land in a war doesn't mean you get to keep it. I mean,
but doctrine says it changes back and forth all over.
Yeah, I mean, that's
this is
crazy.
Doctrine. This is doctrine. Yeah. It is taught in the law schools of Islam. It is taught in the universities. It is adjudicated in the courts of Islamic law. It is taught to the children from the earliest grades of school.
Yeah.
In any case, it is believed and it is acted upon. So let's fast forward then to the Ottoman Empire, because we got to get to the Ottomans, right?
Right.
And by around the 1200s or so, the Turkic tribes were rising and began conquering land over there in what we'd say the Middle East. You know, through the subsequent centuries, they conquered the Ottoman Empire with the Caliphate. Those two parts of the same whole. The Caliphate and the Ottoman Empire conquer a great deal of what we know as the Middle East today. Mm-hmm. And they held that land for many centuries, really, until World War One.
Now, the Ottomans were also Muslim?
Yes, they were, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Ottoman Empire, Caliphate. Two parts of the same whole, Islamic. And as I said, they conquered the whole of the Middle East, really. Again, on up to the gates of Vienna in 1683, when they were finally turned back by Jan Sobieski, the king of Poland, and his mounted hussars. That's the cavalry, and all of their allies that defeated the Ottoman Turks at the gates of Vienna in 1683. On guess which date, by the way? Another fun fact.
October 6th.
September 11th.
Oh, September 11th, you're right.
September 11th, 1683. And that was the beginning of really pushing them back out of southeastern Europe. Of course, the Reconquista had begun a long time prior on the Iberian Peninsula. Long slog, in any case, pushing back. By the 1800s, the Ottoman Empire was known throughout as the sick man of Europe. In other words, it was tottering. As an empire, it was tottering. It was corrupt to the core. It was losing its grip on its territories and so forth. Well, so also by the 1800s, you had Theodor Herzl, in Europe, urging the Jewish people of the diaspora to return to the homeland. Now, remember we talked before about the Mizrahi, the Sephardim, the Ashkenazi Jews. I'm not sure if I ever made the point of those DNA mitochondrial studies, and that was that every single one of those components of Jewish people, wherever they wound up, they carried the same DNA. Which means that at some point in ancient history, before the diaspora, before the dispersal, they were the same people from the same place. That's the only way they could, all of them, in Russia, in Morocco, in Algeria, you know, all and in Israel, all share the exact same mitochondrial traces of the Jewish DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So Theodor Herzl in Europe is now urging Jews of the diaspora return to the homeland, return back to the homeland of the Jewish people. And they did. They started going back, and they started to... I mean, the land had been basically left to rack and ruin by the Ottoman Turks, as I said. They weren't very good administrators by this point. They were losing their, you know, their grip on the lands. They weren't taking care of anything. And the Levant, quite honestly, was a mess. If you've ever read Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad, you'll see the sections there in that book about what a desolate place the Levant was. There were Jews there, of course. These are the Mizrahi Jews that never ever left the land. But it was malaria ridden. It was swampland. It was barren land, and some towns and some agricultural lands among all that. Well, the Jews started coming back, and they started cultivating the land and draining the swamps, and you know, building towns and villages and agriculture. And this was still at that point, 1800s, part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. But then comes World War One. And remember how we said that the Ottoman Empire lost in World War One, and that all that was left of their lands was the borders of the state of Turkey as we know it today. And all these other lands of the Levant, the Turks exited. They were gone. And at that time, early 1920s, we had the League of Nations, right?
Oh, yeah.
The League of Nations, which were really the allied powers, the Western powers, France and Britain and so forth. They were granted what's called mandates by the League of Nations to administer. I mean, somebody's got to do civic administration in these places, and there was no more Ottoman Empire to do it. So the French were given the French mandate in what was now what now is called Syria and Lebanon. Lebanon, of course, ancient Syria, was part of something called Greater Syria. There was no country of Syria, but the French were the administrators of all that part of the land. But the bigger part of it, the much larger part, was the British mandate. And this included all the rest of the Levant, Mediterranean, inland, really all the way to the borders with the Arabian Peninsula. Now, in the early 1920s, as we also know, Ibn Saud was conquering the tribes of the peninsula and forging them into what would become known as Saudi Arabia, his name, of course, right?
Uh-huh.
And the thing is that those tribes had fought on the Allied side of the war, in particular with the British. Remember Lawrence of Arabia, Peter O'Toole, and all that?
Sure.
Right? And in particular, from the movie, as I recall it, there was this railroad that ran north-south down the Red Sea coast of Western Arabia, and Lawrence of Arabia was there with the tribes blowing up the railroad so the Turks couldn't get supplies to wherever. Remember all that?
Yeah.
So there was this closeness, this affinity between the British and these tribes in Arabia before they'd been consolidated. But as that consolidation took place, Ibn Saud conquered a bunch of the tribes that didn't want to be incorporated into a Saudi Arabia. And among those was the Hashemite clan of Mecca. And their title for centuries there had been the Sharifs of Mecca. They administered Mecca and its surroundings. Well, they got kicked out. Ibn Saud took over. They got kicked out. And the British kind of felt sorry for them. And like I said, there was this affinity from the wartime. And they said, well, you know, we British, we got this great big bunch of land mandate from the League of Nations. And yeah, the League of Nations told us that we were supposed to prepare all of it for a modern-day new established nation state for the Jewish people. But, you know, we really feel bad about these Hashemites, the poor guys. We're just going to chop off about 75% of the British mandate that was supposed to be for the Jewish people's new, you know, nation state. And we're going to give it to the Hashemites because, you know, the poor guys, they got kicked out of Mecca. And so they gave all this land, the British, unilaterally, in disobedience of the League of Nations instructions, gave all this land to Abdullah. Abdullah was the grandfather of the current king of Jordan, whose name is also Abdullah. and they named him king, and they put him on a throne, and they said, here, this is yours. Make it your country, and we'll just call it Jordan, after the Jordan River, of course, that runs right through there from antiquity.
And this is around what time?
This is the 1920s.
Okay.
And the land, there had never, ever in history been a country called Jordan, ever. There was the Jordan River and a bunch of tribes.
What?
Well, Abdullah the king, takes over all of this. And over the years, under the League of Nations, it's built out as the new nation state of Jordan. The United Nations, which by the 1940s after World War II succeeds the League of Nations. And at that point in the late 1940s, Jordan is officially named and accepted into the United Nations as an independent country. All that land was supposed to be Jewish. It was for the Jewish people to make their country. But it was taken away from them and just given to Abdullah because. And so the Jewish people were asked, by the League of Nations first and later by the United Nations, well, here, you can have this little sliver that's left over and you want to make a country there? And every time the Jewish people said, yes, we'll take it, we'll make our nation, we'll build our nation. And so it was in 1948 that the modern day Jewish state of Israel was officially announced by the United Nations and declaration by Ben-Gurion in Tel Aviv in May of 1948. And immediately what happens right after the announcement? I mean, literally.
Yeah.
Well, 11 minutes later by telegraph comes the recognition by then U.S. President, who acknowledges that the recognition by the United States of the brand new nation state of Israel. But immediately thereafter, every single surrounding Arab country, including Jordan, invades the new, brand new baby state of Israel. Jordan, Egypt invaded, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, they all invaded the brand new state of Israel, and only by a miracle they survived. We helped them. But that's where Jordan comes from.
That's
where Jordan never existed before. But
right.
but it was populated by a lot of different Arab and Muslim tribes and clans, and they could have declared themselves the two-state solution at any point in time, but they didn't. They did not say that we will be the home for. They were the home for Arab and Muslims who lived there, yes. But there was no such thing as Palestine or calling it Palestinian people. There was no such thing. In all the years since 1940, whatever it was, 8, or maybe, I guess maybe a little bit before that, 46 or 47, when Jordan came to be, all the way, through the various wars, the War of 56, the Suez Canal and all that, and then, later on, the War of 1967, the Six-Day War, when once again all these countries invaded Israel, although Israel preempted that by a preemptive strike against them, which enabled it to survive and win that war. In that war, 67, that is when Israel took control of Gaza, of the Sinai Peninsula, actually, too, and of the entirety of Jerusalem. Remember the picture on the cover of Life magazine, black and white back then? And it was a picture of the Israeli IDF paratroopers who had reached the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall.
Oh, yeah.
For the first time in 2,000 years, Jews prayed at the Western Wall. That was 1967. They also took over all the land of Judea and Samaria, which had been conquered by the brand new Jordan in the War of Independence back in 48-49. But IDF took over all of that, Judea and Samaria, in the War of 67. So, and also the Golan Heights. And so that is when these lands once more, since antiquity really, came under control of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
But never in all of these years and all this history that we've gone through did any of the above, Egypt in Gaza or Jordan in Jordan, ever declare something called Palestine or the Palestinian people. It never occurred to them.
Right.
Where that word came back into usage was 1960s and Yasser Arafat. That's when it was dug back up again and made into a current term.
Holy crap. Well, all this is, you know, we're just inventing all these people out of whole cloth, and the people
exactly.
who've been there for 3,000 years continue to get kicked to the curb.
They've never had a country, never had borders of a country, never had a capital, never had a government, never had a parliament, never had any of that.
Oh,
national anthem, they never had any of that.
Well,
they don't exist.
I just want you to know that I'm getting text messages and emails kind of pouring in. People are like, this is amazing. What a great discussion. I'm getting a lot of...
Oh, good.
So,
oh, I'm glad
so there are people out there kind of going, what the heck? Why isn't anybody talking about this? We have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit more till the top of the hour. You are
all
listening
right.
to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
The worry all the time. If you paid attention, you'd be worried too. You better pay attention, or this world you love so much might just kill you. I could be wrong now, but I don't think so, 'cause it's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there. It's a jungle out there.
Okay, Claire, just so nobody misses it, please go back just a teensy bit and do the where Palestine came from part over again.
You mean the Old Testament part?
No, the like fake Palestine in the 60s, you know,
the
one that they're beating the drum about now.
The word itself, of course, comes out of the Old Testament and the Roman usage of it to obliterate the identity of the Jewish people with that land, but more in modern times. Okay, so...
Sorry.
You know, post-World War II, British felt sorry for their wartime allies, the Arabs, gave away the majority part of the British mandate that the League of Nations told them to prepare for Jewish nationhood, gave it to the Hashemite clan, which, by the way, is riding a tiger. The Hashemite clan under this King Abdullah riding a tiger in Jordan, which never ever called it Palestinian, Palestine, anything, because the majority of the people there view the Hashemites almost as like carpetbaggers that came in after they got kicked out of Saudi Arabia, kicked out of Mecca, and they don't view them as native to that particular land. And the Muslim Brotherhood holds a lot of sway in Jordan and is constantly challenging it. And, oh, by the way, very recently, the Islamic Republic of Iran is trying to stir up trouble in Jordan, allying. They've long been, we can go into this another time, but the Shiite Iranian leadership has long been allied with the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, trying to stir up trouble there in Jordan, which would complete their ring of fire, as they call it, around Israel. So there's all that going on. But so in the 1960s, of course, you've got Yasser Arafat. He is backed, funded, armed, trained by the KGB. They were trained, by the way, in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon, where followers of the then, at that time, exiled Ayatollah Khomeini, not Khomeini, the current supreme leader, the first one, Khomeini, were trained under the KGB. And so Yasser Arafat is trying to figure out a way in the 1960s now of how to fight Israel. Now, he too, you know, goes back and does a little bit of history and searching and comes upon the name that the Romans had slapped onto the region. Ah, Philistia, Palestinians. Oh, yeah, that's what we'll call it. And so he drags this out of the history books himself, too, and for the first time forms something called the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It had never existed before in the imagination of anybody in the world, except maybe the Romans. Drags that out. That's where that comes from. But the point being here of the last segment is that Jordan had the chance to be what I would call the first chance at a two-state solution, Gaza being the second, but that Jordan could have been that two-state solution, home for these people, these Arabs and Muslims that did not have citizenship in any of the other brand new countries, by the way, that were formed after World War II and so forth. I mean, there never was an Iraq before. The British did the same thing there, put a king on the throne. That was three vilayets, governorships of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. There was no Iraq. Lebanon, as I said, from antiquity, of course, the Phoenicians, Syria. But in any case, King Hussein, who was the father of the current King Abdullah, fought the Muslim Brotherhood. Remember Black September of 1970, when the Yasser Arafat's PLO rose up against the Hashemite monarchy of Jordan, then King Hussein. And he, King Hussein, mustered the Bedouin guards, and it was a bloody massacre of Arafat's people. His militia forces kicked them out of Jordan. Where'd they go next? They went to Lebanon, which they destabilized next. We can talk about that another time. But they were kicked out of Jordan. And every place they've ever been, these people that began under, organized at least, under the PLO of Yasser Arafat, they've caused trouble. They destabilized Lebanon. That's what's going on in Lebanon right now. We can talk about that later another time. But that's what's happening in Lebanon right now. The what's left over from that displacement of Yasser Arafat's PLO, 1970 Black September. They were the ones, by the way, Munich Massacre. Yes. Olympics 1972, Black September, that's why they called it that, because Black September of 1970 is when Hussein kicked them out of Jordan. But at no time in Jordan was Jordan ever called the two-state solution, home of something called, made-up imaginary Palestine or Palestinian people. Never, ever, because he knew, the Hashemite monarchs all knew, Abdullah to Hussein to the current Abdullah, all knew, know that these people are trouble wherever they go.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's pretty handily proven, even to the most novice of Middle Eastern scholars.
So in summation here, the two-state solution has been tried multiple times, and for these people, including a current candidate for president, is touting the two-state solution.
Why doesn't it succeed? The reason it doesn't succeed is that none of these pretenders to a new state has any intention of there being two states living side by side in peace.
Right.
The Israeli Jewish state of Israel and some other carved out of the living body of the state of Israel land. There's no intention of living side by side. Go back to the Hamas covenant. Will exist. Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam obliterates it. They have no intention of two states side by side. From the river to the sea. You know, our stupid ignoramuses on our college campuses chant this over and over. They have no idea which river, and they have no idea which sea. But the river is the Jordan River. The sea is the Mediterranean. And if you wipe it all out of the Jewish presence, there's only one state left. And it's not the Jewish state of Israel. Mm-hmm. It's genocide.
Right.
That's what they're
right.
calling for, whether they know it or not.
I think they do know it.
Some do. A lot of them are too stupid to know where the Jordan, I mean, that there even is a Jordan River.
No, they're just following.
Mike on campus interviews, you know, you ask them, or the interviewer asks them,
sure.
Oh, which river? Amazon? Or the biggest or not? They have no idea.
I know it. I've seen those, and it just drives me nuts how stupid some of these people are.
Yeah.
Well, and as somebody who's an expert.
They don't teach geography.
No.
But as an expert on the Middle East, really. When you see the LGBT blah 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 for Hamas, for Palestine,
oh, yeah.
for this
oh,
and that and the other,
that is the most hilarious thing on earth.
I yeah, every time I see one of those signs, I'm like, oh, I bet Claire is doubled over.
That they have no idea what would happen to them if they were to relocate to those areas.
Just in case they accidentally turn to this channel,
just real quick.
Yeah, do that.
FYI. Mm-hmm. There are 7 major crimes under Islamic law. The 7 major crimes are called hudud crimes, and they come straight out of the Quran, and the punishments do too. Among the 7 are things like highway robbery, apostasy, adultery. Oh, yeah, and oh, by the way, homosexuality.
Yeah, yeah, that's
not
a biggie.
Not doing anything, just being homosexual, automatically under Islamic law brings capital punishment, the death penalty.
Yeah.
That is law. And it's enforced in places around the Muslim world.
Yeah. And it wasn't too long ago they were on the news, gays for, what was it? It was gays for Hamas or something.
Yeah,
it's like, you people are so stupid.
That is not an option.
No, that's not an option.
You know, we could maybe chip in and give them all one-way tickets.
Yeah, we should
see how that works
agree
out.
With that.
We should start tours. We should get a tour.
yeah, there you go.
A tour company.
And failing that, maybe a new university-level course or two on Islamic law, that is Sharia, and what it actually says. Could be just a semester. That'd be enough.
Yeah, that'd be enough.
Well, how long would they? There's no. I mean, you're not having like a trial and a discussion. And
oh, there is a trial. It lasts about 5 minutes.
okay.
And then you are sent off to execution.
Yeah.
Literally,
yeah. It was no. It was no mistake.
Law. Yeah, around the world, enforce this all over the world.
Oh yeah. Well, it wasn't that long ago. They were throwing them off the roofs, remember? And
not for being gay, but for being Palestinian Authority.
Yeah.
So,
but nevertheless.
So, if you are, if you're in Israel at this point, I mean these guys are. I mean, we just did the show about the the beepers and all that kind of stuff. I mean, these guys are incredibly good at defending themselves. No wonder. And
they have to be. They wouldn't be there if they weren't good at it.
Yeah. So they're the best
and
of the best.
But in my opinion, super lucky to have Benjamin Netanyahu as their prime minister right now.
And now why do you say that?
Because he is leading the country, the people of Israel, the IDF, to absolutely dismantle the proxy jihadi terrorist forces that the Islamic State of Israel, of Iran, pardon me, the Islamic Republic of Iran established. In other words, dismantling Hamas, Pidge, and Hezbollah before our eyes, which were the insurance policy, the defense forces for the Islamic Republic of Iran, which soon now will stand naked and alone.
Yeah, he and of course they make it look like he's just this monster leading this assault on these innocent people. But you know, the minute
Israel was attacked first.
Exactly. Even during the ceasefires
and October the 7th, the horrific. I participated, by the way, in a wonderful ceremony program up on Capitol Hill at the Rayburn Building, Washington, D.C., on October the 7th, organized by Edwin Black, wonderful Jewish leader and radio show host, as a matter of fact, in commemoration of what happened on October 7th. So they were not only invaded and attacked and mutilated and executed, but then others, not only then, but before then, but certainly after then, joined in.
Yeah.
Hezbollah. Launching rockets
and they're not letting up.
There's also
Claire, we have to run away.
We'll do anticipatory self-defense. Remember,
we will do this as soon as we can with you again. Our guest has been Claire Lopez. Thank you so much. You can find
great
us.
Show, Claire.
Please
thank
send
the
show to your friends so they can all smarten up. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Thank you very much.
Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back, though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.